Luke makes one thing clear in this text, that Jesus was driven to the cliff to be killed by the people. What isn't clear is what was driving the people. What's also unclear is, how does Jesus get away? To figure out what was driving the people, we need to back up a little bit from the start of this story. 480 million years ago, a trilobite in the Sonoran Desert found a worm. This is the oldest meal we have on record. It was a fossil that Mark McMiniman, it's such a great name, that's why I had to remember it. Anyway, he found this fossil, and on the fossil there was a trilobite. It was obvious, and there was a bit of scratches on the trilobite, which is common when trilobites, you know, moved around a bit before being entombed. And under the trilobite, there's evidence of the movement of something else, but it's only half of a worm with the trilobite on top. Since the Cambrian period, when life exploded on this planet, there's been a simple dynamic governing life. I kill, then I live because I eat what I've killed. In order for us to live, plants and animals must die first. I don't think that's exactly what was driving the folks in the synagogue in Nazareth. Their intent wasn't to kill and eat Jesus. That comes later. And I don't think that trilobite had much going on besides some sort of impulse to consume and live. Consumption takes on much more complex things for us humans. If you want to go sort of defining it by the negative route, like lots of early Enlightenment thinkers did, well, in fact, up to the last 30, 40 years, Freud would describe why we do everything as an avoidance of pain or to just relieve negative tension. Everything falls into that. So it's, I eat because I'm hungry, or I drink because I'm thirsty. It's to avoid that bad feeling. William Blake, who did much for Christianity in the Enlightenment, he understood the greatest pleasure to be the absence of pain. In fact, this isn't so far off from what John, when he was marooned and writing about the final things, in that second-to-last chapter of Genesis, when the New Jerusalem descends, it's defined by the absence of tears, the absence of sickness, the absence of death. That has a part. We have a very strong mechanism within us for disgust and distaste and avoiding bad things. If you put something in your mouth that's far too bitter, we all make the same face. Blah! We've got little stickers that make it, and we all know what they mean immediately because we know that face. It's physically expelling it from our bodies and getting rid of it. Too bitter, too salty, too moldy. It's buried deep within our brain. That same part of our brain that spits out gross things is also how we understand fairness. It's driven from the same place. In the late 80s, a researcher did an experiment to show this connection. She hooked the subjects up with, you know, scanning their brain, which parts of the brain light up, right? First round, subjects were given different things to smell, some of them pleasing, like strawberry-laced water, you know, pleasure parts of the brain light up. And then other foul, gross things, and a specific region lights up, and it's disgusting. A different group observed the same way, set up this experiment where there was two people. The one being observed was made an offer, and the rules were simple. Person A has $10, and they propose to person B, who's being observed of what happens in their brain, a way to split the $10. And there's an ultimatum. They either accept the deal or no one gets anything. The $10 is destroyed, right? When a good deal is offered, I'll give you $9 and just keep one for myself. Yeah, absolutely. They take it, you know, no questions asked. They're just all over it. Happy things. As it gets even, it's less happy, but they're ready to take the deal. I'll take $5, you take $5. Great. As we start to approach what seems like less of a fair deal for the person, I'm going to keep $6, but you get $4. Okay, fine. When it gets to, I'm going to keep $9, you can have $1. What? Anger. I mean, you don't have to have monitoring what's happening in the brain. They started name-calling, knowing full well that this is an experiment and, you know, just judging reactions. But that sense of fairness, and it's the exact same thing when they smelled the glass that smelled like poop. It's the same thing that lights up when they're offered $1 of the 10. The people in the synagogue were offered something unfair. They knew Jesus. They put up with him his entire childhood and adolescence. They knew he was out curing people, performing all sorts of great miracles. And then he comes home, and they're like, look at this guy. We know him. It's Joseph's kid. And then he says, yeah, I'm not giving you any. You can't have my healings. What? It's like he only offered him a dollar. In fact, he's like, well, I've got $10 and you get $0. How do you like that deal? So they're enraged. We could stop there and then, you know, they take him out to the cliff and Jesus ducks out, right? I mean, maybe it's sort of like after the resurrection when the disciples are locked in a house and suddenly Jesus is there with them, as if like he became incorporeal for a second and like, ooh, just came right through the wall. Semi-ghost Jesus that solidifies again on the other side. It's an uninteresting miracle if Jesus just slips out or ducks out, right? It's barely miraculous. Or they're just distracted and he, ducks out the other way. But here's the thing about the way Blake and Freud understood our motivations. They were wrong. Because we're not just driven by avoiding pain. We don't live in a world that simply is trying to have the least amount of hurt. Sure, that's part of it. Because they're getting a bad deal, but they're also thinking about what's coming. We're smarter than that trilobite. We know how to think ahead and plan and manipulate things to our advantage and our life. That's why we've selected particular crops and animals and bred them to sustain us in the best possible ways. You can take a rat and you can stimulate that part of its brain that says, like, this is terrible, yuck. But you can also stimulate that part of the brain at the same time that says, this is really amazing, I want it. And you can teach a rat to eat disgusting things. Our ability for pleasure can completely override that distaste, that unfairness. the positive is so much stronger than the negative. Paul gets that. This reading from 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about the same thing as the marooned John talking about the end of the world. But Paul defines it only in the positive. The complete, the fullness of creation, salvation, the new creation is defined in terms of love. Love that bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, is all things. We only get that in part, though. We're not very good at the positive, even though it's the driving most dominant force in our lives. Because while the people thought it was a bad deal, it was like, well, what about when I get sick? I'm going to need to get healed. Someday, I'm going to be hurt, and I need to know Jesus has got my back to heal me. And if he doesn't, that's a bum deal. I'm upset. We've built our society around trying to have this pleasure all the time. Since at least the 6th century, all large empires have been built around one thing: sugar. I'm not kidding. Sugar. Since we domesticated cane sugar and processing it, that has been a driving force in societies and empires. Because there's nothing that pleases our bodies and our minds more than the sweet taste of sugar. It's the reason there's high fructose corn syrup in absolutely everything we eat. Because nothing fits the receptors on our tongue more perfectly than fructose. So if you did a jigsaw puzzle and every single piece fit every single other piece and made something beautiful, no matter how you put them together, that's the way our tongues dance with fructose, which is present in sugar, right? I mean, that's one half of what sugar is. This dates back to the Islamic Empire. They brought cane sugar across their empire, and then Europe caught on, and then we spread it to the New World. That's what Columbus was doing, and those who came after him in the New World. They turned this whole area into sugar plantations, and sweetness and rum ruled the day. We want to have that sweet experience all the time. But the dynamic we live in is kill the sugar cane, I eat sugar. Jesus undoes this entire dynamic. Whether it be this reflexive kill-eat, whether it be this avoidance of pain, or even if it's just this pleasure, 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 which gets us to bad places too, right? I mean, you can have too much sugar. Just read anything from a nutritionist in the past however many years, and they'll tell you all about how sugar is a problem. In fact, I mean, it doesn't have to just be sugar. Like, anyone who's ever had a Thanksgiving meal and overate, you know that, like, those pleasure things can make us push ourselves too uncomfortable and even beyond. The thing driving the people is this crazy cocktail of disgust and unfairness at what Jesus offers, but also this great desire for the pleasure of being cured and healed and always in good health. It's what drives most of what we do, most of what we consume, most of how we interact with each other. And that's where the miracle happens. That's where Jesus comes in, and that's how Jesus gets away. He plays to who we are and then creates what Paul's talking about. Seems like I made a crazy leap. Let me back up. When Jesus makes the people all outraged in the synagogue, we have no evidence that anyone was immediately in need of healing. There's no statement of Jesus taught in the synagogue and there was a man blind from birth there. It doesn't say that Jesus taught in the synagogue and there was lepers standing outside. These are just people who are pretty well off, came to church, decently comfortable. You could complain, but I don't need, you know, the hand of God to fix my immediate problems right now. And when Jesus says, well, I'm not going to cure people here, and they start thinking, well, what if I need it? What if I need to be cured? When I get sick, I want someone there to cure me. And he tells them that they can't have it. So they get mad on their own account. They're thinking about themselves. They're turned in, navel-gazing, sinful people. Basic Reformation understanding of sin is the self turned in on the self. As they drive Jesus to the cliff, which, by the way, he completely orchestrates. It's not the people who say, cure yourself, and it's not the people who say, do for us here also. Jesus is the one who gives them these ideas. The only thing they say in the story is like, wow, isn't this Joseph's son? He makes them angry on purpose. He uses that disgust reflex. And as they're riding him out of town, they start to realize, oh, hey, what if you get sick? Or what if you get sick? Or what if you need to be cured? And suddenly, there's a community. Suddenly, there's a group of people existing in love. Not a bunch of people concerned about themselves, about their pain, about their cures. It's suddenly about the community. And then Jesus can just walk away because their anger has been overridden with the pleasure. The absence of sickness or the absence of hunger or the absence of anything else no longer matters because there's love. Love bears all things, is all things, hopes all things. That's the consummation and the peak of all that is. What God made us for and how God views us. This love that Paul is talking about is something that we see in part, as if in a mirror dimly. But that's fully the way God sees us and loves us and exists towards us. And we can take this as sort of a condescending thing. While we were still dead in sin, God stooped so low as to be one of us, to be among us. But that's defining God in this avoidance of pain sort of way, that love is this coping with pain. But it's part of that complex cocktail where pleasure and disgust can commingle and create something even more beautiful. We spit out bitter, but coffee that doesn't have a bitter edge would seem flabby and unenjoyable. These things have a place in the spice of existence and life. Love is too cloying sometimes, right? I mean, we've all seen a Valentine's Day card or a wedding card or an anniversary card. You know, it's saccharine-y, gross, sticky love that doesn't quite make sense. But someone weeping at the side of their loved one's hospital bed, that's love. It makes sense. It's full of death and pain and stinging. It's bearing all things. Back to my trilobite. We're about to have a meal. And it's not the same dynamic anymore. The Cambrian intervention of kill and eat is undone. Sure, Jesus has died. But death isn't such a major part of the equation anymore. Because we're joined with the risen Christ when we eat Christ. Christ lives. We eat Christ. We live together. It's the same dynamic that happened at the cliff, and it's the opposite dynamic that happened with the worm. Eat the living Christ. Be the living Christ. Grasp a glimpse of that love. For that love rules all and all. And then we will fully see the love as we've already been loved that way. Amen.